Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sanjeev Berry of Amnesty International, who talks about his group's call for an immediate arms embargo against the Syrian government and other actions to reduce the violence in that war-torn nation. Journalist and author Mark Hertzgard, who assesses the worsening weather and environmental conditions connected with climate change, and a new group he's organizing called Climate Parents. And Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at truthdig.com, who discusses the international LIBOR scandal, the latest example of the finance industry's culture of corruption. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Haiti has the potential for a $20 billion gold rush as Canadian mining companies lock away land claims in the island's northern hills. According to the Interpress service, Canadian companies have already spent $30 million in Haiti collecting samples, digging test sites, and building roads. The huge potential for riches has also led to a series of backroom deals involving former Haitian officials, reports Haiti Grassroots Watch. Haiti's share of mineral royalties would be among the lowest in the Americas. These and other corrupt practices led Haitian mining agency head Dussul Anglade to resign in protest. The former mining minister told Haiti Grassroots Watch, "Mines are the public property of the state. They are for the population. They are not the property of people in power." Meanwhile, two Canadian companies, Eurasian Minerals and Newmont Mining, are waiting for Haitian officials, including Prime Minister Laurent Lamothe, to sign a convention which sets the terms of open-pit mining in Haiti. The area in question covers over 1,300 square kilometers of land. Open-pit mining is hazardous due to the use of cyanide and other toxic chemicals, which have a long history of polluting freshwater supplies around the world. The land in Haiti set to be mined is an area with critical biodiversity resources and is currently cultivated by local farmers. In the early days of the Obama administration, commitments were made to create government-funded green jobs with a focus on weatherizing homes in lower-income communities. Building trade unions signed up for the initiative, including the Laborers Union, which set up a program to weatherize 1 million homes a year. The U.S. Department of Energy reported last fall that over 500,000 homes were weatherized and 14,000 jobs were created with stimulus money. The program helped cement a new partnership between construction unions and immigrant-based community groups. According to Labor Notes magazine, weatherization, like most residential construction, is a low-wage industry dominated by small contractors. In the state of Massachusetts, the utilities that funded the state weatherization program kept bids and profit margins low, squeezing out larger contractors who pay higher wages. But the Green Justice Committee, an alliance of unions, community groups, and environmental activists, stepped in to negotiate two agreements with state utility companies, which boosted wages between 25 and 95%. The alliance stuck together after the stimulus funds expired, enabling unions to call on community allies to campaign for union jobs for major contractors. In late 2001, Air Force Captain Allison Black flew an AC-130H gunship helicopter, guiding U.S. Special Forces and directing the fire from Gatling guns and artillery against Taliban fighters in Afghanistan. Now a major, Black was the first woman to win the Air Force Combat Action Medal. According to the Christian Science Monitor, a decade later, women soldiers play key roles in the Afghan war, making up 16% of U.S. forces in-country. But women are held back by military tradition and biased rules that prevent female soldiers from being assigned to combat roles. A congressional study group on military leadership diversity recently suggested the Pentagon lift their combat exclusion policy. However, the military brass decided to keep the policy in place while opening up 14,000 new positions to women, such as truck mechanics. In May, Army Reserve Colonel Ellen Herring, a graduate of West Point, became a plaintiff in a lawsuit to allow women to fight in combat. Herring, who bumped up against the glass ceiling in the military, says the lawsuit is one more angle of attack on a really discriminatory policy that is completely un-American. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
As escalating violence in Syria moves towards a 17th month, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights estimates that the death toll now exceeds 17,000. As pressure mounts for the international community to take action to quell the violence in Syria, the government of Russian President Vladimir Putin has shown signs of distancing itself from its longtime ally in Damascus. Moscow recently announced that it would restrict new arms shipments to Syria, even as it continues to honor past military contracts with the government of President Bashar al-Assad. Russian diplomats also recently met with a delegation of opponents of the Syrian regime, signaling that they may be preparing for a future Syria without Mr. Assad. Meanwhile, former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan continues to try to salvage his three-month-long effort to negotiate a peaceful settlement in Syria, recently meeting with Mr. Assad, opposition groups, and representatives of the Iranian government. In recent days, the Assad regime has seen significant defections from the ranks of the military. Brigadier General Manaf Tass, a commander in the powerful Republican Guard and the son of a former defense minister, reportedly left Syria, a move that some observers believe will encourage more defections by top officials. Your reporter spoke with Sanjeev Berry, Amnesty International's advocacy director for the Middle East and North Africa, who talks about his group's call for an immediate arms embargo against the Syrian government and other actions to reduce and eventually end the violence.
The uprising began, or the conflict and the violence began when peaceful protests with regards to how some Syrian children were being treated by the prison officials and by law enforcement officials were then treated with violence by the government, and that then escalated from there. And so while we can certainly call it a civil conflict, and in some parts of the country it's taking on those contours of a full-scale internal conflict within a country, much of the violence and much of the death toll is the result of the Syrian army and Syrian armed forces' crimes against humanity, in which there has been what looks to be an organized, targeted campaign of violence against civilian populations carried out by the government's armed forces. Now, of course, we're getting increasing reports of human rights abuses by different opposition forces or opposition groups, but the bulk of the violence remains to have been committed by the Syrian government's armed militias, armed forces.
Sanjeev, I'd like to talk about some recent developments. There was news that Russia announced they would no longer sign new arms sales agreements with Damascus, and I'm wondering how significant that is in terms of Russia softening their position on, backing the regime of Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian president.
Well, I think there's two ways of looking at that certain new news development. One is that it shows that the Russian government is paying attention to global opinion, that they don't necessarily want to be seen as outright aiding and abetting the violence. But on the other hand, Amnesty International considers that statement by the Russian government to be pretty feeble. And the reason why is because they're not saying that they're going to be cutting off pre-existing military contracts or supplies or deliverables. And that's the real question, not a decision to stop, quote-unquote, new supplies and new armaments being shipped, but what about all the pre-existing contracts?
Sanjeev, we also hear reports about former United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan and his latest efforts to negotiate an end to the conflict in Syria. His efforts heretofore have not met with success, but he's got a new round of talks he's had with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, and he's also scheduled to talk with some opposition groups. Do you have any hope that Kofi Annan can make a breakthrough here?
I think the global community and the global human rights community is certainly deeply appreciative of Mr. Annan's efforts to try to bring an end to the violence. You had mentioned 17,000 names. On our more conservative side, we've received the names of 12,000 people who've been killed, but the total number could certainly be far higher. And with regards to Mr. Annan's efforts, we all certainly want to see him succeed. The challenge, though, is that so far that latest news report, at least from what I've seen, hasn't given any specifics. And the underlying problem is that the Syrian government continues to wage war through its armed forces and through these allied Shabia militias against the civilian population. And that's why Amnesty International is calling for, a global arms embargo on the government to stop the flow of weapons.
What are some of the other demands that are being placed on the international community here? Has the international community responded in a way that you feel is responsible in terms of doing all they can to quell the rising violence in Syria?
No, the international community has fallen far short of what can be done. The U.N. Security Council needs to stop dithering. The Russian and Chinese governments need to stop shielding the Syrian government by using their veto power to block U.N. Security Council action. But then on top of that, Western governments and other governments at the U.N. and U.N. Security Council level also haven't taken the step of calling for the entire matter of the atrocities and human rights violations in Syria to be sent to the International Criminal Court. And Amnesty International wants to see actual global International Criminal Court investigations that have the force of international law so that the people behind much of the violence are prosecuted. Right now, the international community hasn't been doing that and pushing for that. And so as a result, we have this climate of impunity.
What role has the Obama administration played in this rising violence we've seen in Syria over these last 16 months?
Well, the Obama administration, certainly by calling on the Syrian government to stand down from the violence, by being very critical of the Russian government's arms transfers to Syria, has played a constructive role in that regard. But the Obama administration hasn't done a number of things as well. I mean, for one thing, they haven't called for the International Criminal Court to take up the matter, which is something that the U.N. Security Council needs to do. Since Syria is not a party to the International Criminal Court, the U.N. Security Council has to say to the International Criminal Court, you can investigate before the ICC can do that. And so the Obama administration hasn't called for that. Part of the reason might be that the United States, of course, isn't even a party to the International Criminal Court, which is a big challenge. So that's one thing that the Obama administration can do. You know, globally, there needs to be an arms embargo on the Syrian government, and there also needs to be a freeze on the assets of the senior leadership of the Syrian government, including Mr. Bashar al-Assad himself. None of these things have happened yet, and the violence continues as a result.
That was Sanjeev Berry, Amnesty International's Advocacy Director for the Middle East and North Africa. For more analysis of the conflict in Syria, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The year 2012 is on track to be the hottest in recorded history, while high temperatures and drought conditions have been linked to destructive forest fires and other natural disasters that are exactly the kinds of occurrences that climate scientists have predicted will come with global warming. Yet the June Rio+20 United Nations Conference on Sustainable Development, which commemorated the first Earth Summit held in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil in 1992, was widely criticized as a failure for producing an international agreement which lacks enforceable commitments to confront and reverse climate change. Mark Hertzgard, author of Earth Odyssey, reports on the environment for The Nation magazine, Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, and other publications. His newest book is titled Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, which he wrote for his daughter's generation. Hertzgard says after his daughter Kiara was born 7 years ago, he became even more adamant about addressing climate change and holding to account the political and business leaders who ignore the Earth's and its people's plight. In his book, he notes that climate change has arrived almost a century ahead of predictions. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mark Hertzgard about the worsening weather and environmental conditions connected with climate change and a new group he's organizing called Climate Parents.
We are living with climate change now. It is going to get worse simply because of the inertia, the physical inertia of the climate system, the fact that carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for decades after it's emitted. So we've got a big job ahead of us, there's no doubt. And meanwhile, we've got the President of the United States not saying a word about global warming, even though he knows perfectly well what the science tells him. We don't see any real leadership coming from the national level. So I think it really is going to, as always in history, it's really going to rely on people from the bottom organizing together and forcing their leaders to do what's right. And that's something that I'm getting started now with a group called Climate Parents. We want to try and organize and mobilize parents around the climate issue because it certainly endangers climate change endangers the thing that we all hold most dear in our lives, which is our kids.
Say more about Climate Parents.
Climate Parents is a new group that a number of us are just beginning now, and its agenda is simple. We think that parents are the single most underorganized constituency on climate change, which is quite bizarre when you think of what's at stake for our kids. And so what we want to do is to give voice and political impact to parents across the country and across the partisan political spectrum. We don't believe that climate change should be a partisan political issue because we think all parents want to have a safe and healthy future for their kids. But we also think that dealing with the climate issue now is part of your job description as a parent, just like providing your kid with proper food and clothing and shelter and health care and all those things. Climate change and dealing with it is now part of the job description of being a parent, because we now know that my daughter, Kiara, who's 7 years old, she and the rest of her generation are now fated to spend the rest of their lives coping with what will be the hottest and most volatile climate in the 10,000 years of human civilization. So you can think of today's young people as what I call Generation Hot. And we owe it to them, having put them in this predicament. We owe it to them as their parents, their grandparents, their aunts and uncles, anyone who cares about young people. We owe it to them to try and find the ways to let them cope with this problem successfully. And let's emphasize here, we know how to deal with climate change. We have the solutions. We know what to do technologically. It's all there, solar and wind power and geothermal and energy efficiency and all of the other solutions. I go into them in great depth in my book, Hot. That's not the problem. The problem is the lack of political will and the fact that our government is still under the control of very large business interests who profit from the current situation. The oil companies, the coal companies, natural gas. I mean, it is remarkable and bizarre that our tax dollars are now being spent in the billions to subsidize ExxonMobil, the single richest, most profitable corporation in human history. We are subsidizing them to wreck the climate for our kids.
Mark Hertzgard, so this is a group to apply political pressure on officials.
We do think that it does have to be political involvement. It's nice and it's important as a first step for a family to change their lifestyle choices and the consumption patterns so that you know, maybe you take mass transit more often than the car, maybe you eat less meat, more vegetables, and, you know, take the bicycle and all of these sorts of, there's a lot of personal lifestyle changes that you can make, and those are useful. But they are much, much less than what is necessary to solve this problem. As long as we have an economic system and rules of the road economically that essentially allow carbon dioxide pollution to be emitted for free, nobody pays a price for that, certainly not the corporations or us, the consumers. It's not incorporated into the price. Indeed, as I said, we're subsidizing oil and coal and natural gas. As long as that's the case, we can't make much difference. We've got to change the main drivers of climate change, and those are the government policies and the business practices of today's world. We can do this. We know how to do this. It's a matter of changing the big political decisions, and that requires people to get involved in politics. I know for some people that's about as enticing a prospect as getting a root canal, but I just would remind you, especially if you're a parent or a grandparent, that, you know, there's a lot of things that we don't really feel like doing, but we do them because they will make a difference for our kids.
That was journalist and author Mark Hertzgard. Learn more about his group, Climate Parents, and the effects of climate change on weather and the environment by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The latest scandal to erupt in the world of finance involves the little-known London Interbank Offered Rate, or LIBOR. Data submitted by major banking institutions is collected, calculated, and used as a benchmark to determine interest rates for interbank loans, as well as $350 trillion worth of consumer products, such as credit cards, private student loans, auto loans, and adjustable-rate mortgages. Investigations in the United Kingdom and the U.S. have uncovered evidence that LIBOR interest rates have been intentionally manipulated by banks over a period of years. While some of the LIBOR rate manipulation may have been motivated to falsely project the financial health of banks in the period around the recent global financial meltdown, other manipulation appears to be linked to individual traders' goal of gaining short-term profits. In either case, however, the bottom line of the scandal is that large amounts of money have been systematically and intentionally stolen from average people all around the world while enriching a small circle of bankers and financial brokers. Investigators in the United Kingdom initially focused on the involvement of Barclays Bank of Britain, whose CEO Bob Diamond was forced to resign as his bank paid $450 million to settle accusations of illegal interest rate manipulation. Other banks which may soon face prosecution and civil litigation include J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and UBS. Your reporter spoke with Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at TruthDig.com, former Los Angeles Times national correspondent and author of the book The Great American Stick-Up. Here he discusses the LIBOR scandal as the latest example of the finance industry's culture of corruption.
The basic incentive, this all started as the markets were collapsing in 2007, 2008, they wanted to show that aside from government infusions of money, they could go out on the open market and raise money at a reasonable rate. So their obligation was to honestly report what they were having to pay for money to make loans out in the market. And one of their big incentives was to make it seem like they were so solid that they could get money at a reasonable rate. That was one of the big incentives here, but they also were covering their bets on all sorts of things, they make money on those bets and on the derivatives that have been sold and what's in those packages. Sometimes that is to the benefit of other people. For instance, since so much of the housing mortgage stuff was dependent upon interest rates and keeping interest rates low, they wanted to keep that rate low. But they also were betting, and they bet against themselves, they bet against their products, they bet every different way, and they were reaping enormous profit from what is basically insider trading. If they can set the rate, then they can bet that the rate will be a certain place. And that's really what happened here. There was collusion. And the reason they got nailed is the same reason Ken Lay got nailed at Enron, was there's an email trail. And the government and both the Justice Department here and over in England were able to get these emails. And the cynicism of all this was revealed, as it was in Enron, you know, collusion between the banks and let's hustle and let's swindle the average consumer. And that's what happened here. And there was testimony by one of the leading figures in the English government confirming that it was the bank's responsibility. This is by no means over. It was a plea bargain. Barclays agreed to pay $450 million in penalty. They accepted the facts, which are disastrous, but there will be a lot of lawsuits going after the people involved, because the people on the other end, when they made money, other people lost money. That's how it works. So if you're rigging these rates so that your bets come out looking good, other people are going to be hurt by it. And they also have lawyers, and they can go sue and show damages. Barclays itself got immunity because it's assumed they will now help both of these governments on both sides of the Atlantic figure this stuff out and go after the other banks. And so that's the next stage. And this is by no means over. We're now going to go through each bank, and we're going to have lots of lawsuits, and this will go on for a decade.
Is there any way to estimate, with so many trillions of dollars involved here, the amount of money that was stolen from average consumers? Like, as you referred to, it affected mortgage rates and entire cities like Baltimore were affected. Is there any way to estimate what was stolen?
Well, those estimates will come from the lawsuits. I mean, trust me, the people who run pension funds and, you know, who have lost big money, they also have lawyers and accountants, and they will assess damages just as they did when they went off after Bernie Madoff, who was really an amateur a joke compared to what these people do. I think the real cause is what it's done to the world economy. You know, you can't trust economic activity. You can't trust what the Spanish do. You can't trust what the Italians do. You can't trust what the Americans do. And when you have this lack of confidence in the international economy, you don't know what to price anything. You don't know what investments. You don't know where the market's going to be in the future. So the costs ultimately are absolutely disastrous.
Let's talk about accountability. There's a term called moral hazard. And if people are not punished for the crimes, economic crimes that we have unfolding over these bunch of years, they'll go out and do it again. And we have that right now, don't we? Moral hazard, because the laws as they are written cannot keep these bankers accountable who commit such devastating crimes.
You know, it's deeper than that. You sort of have to go back to, I don't know, Confucius, Aristotle, Jesus, you know, some of the Old Testament wisdom about usury. There always was a teaching of accountability. Don't take advantage of the vulnerable. Don't fleece the poor. You know, don't lie and swindle your fellow tribesmen. We lost all that. What we started teaching in the business schools, the law schools, was how to be a legal swindler. Ethics came to be defined as what can you do right up to the edge of the law that will profit you, and if you can't do it there, let's change the law. So we'll make things that should be, obviously should be illegal, we'll make them legal. That's what happened here. So it's really very dangerous when the smartest people, the people who test the best, go to the best schools, then turn that into a craftiness, into a, they become swindlers. That is really the omnipresent danger in this world right now. We have the hustlers in charge. And because of things like, Supreme Court decisions on campaign finance, Citizens United, this sort of thing, the role of money in the current presidential election, there's no limit to their greed, and as a result, they will suffocate on their own greed. You talk about moral hazard, not only don't they go to jail, they're not shamed in any way. They're still admitted to polite company. They're still honored. And they probably won't go to jail, and they'll have their, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars and billions of dollars put away. And you're right, moral hazard is the right word. There's no accountability. There's no shame. And since they control the media and political system, there isn't much likelihood that they are going to be subject to shame.
That was Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at TruthDig.com and author of the book, The Great American Stick-Up, How Reagan Republicans and Clinton Democrats Enriched Wall Street While Mugging Main Street. For more information on the LIBOR and related financial scandals, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.